You guys like to convene the Ways and Means Committee, and Representative Nelson, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, and I move approval. Yeah, I move approval of the minutes.
Okay, the motion is before us to approve the minutes of March 11, 2019. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. The first bill that we have up this morning is House File 286 by Representative Hornstein. The rail carrier minimum crew size required. Representative Hornstein, would you care to move the division report?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the division report on, this is the Transportation Finance and Policy Division report on House File 286.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then. Representative Torkelson.
Yeah, could you clarify the motion, Mr. Chair?
We're adopting the committee report from the Transportation Committee.
So this isn't sending it anywhere yet?
No.
All right, I'll wait.
So the motion before us, just adopt the committee report, and then there will be a follow-up motion by Representative Hornstein. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 286 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay, that motion is before us. Representative Hornstein, would you care to tell us a little bit about the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 286 is a requirement for a two-person crew on freight railroad lines. This legislation has been passed in several other states. It came to my attention back in 2013. There were a number of high-profile accidents involving freight rail in other states and in Minnesota. Particularly as it relates to oil and other hazardous materials, and I view this as a safety question above all, and that's why I'm supportive and hope you'll be supportive of this legislation.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Representative Torkelson.
My first question, Mr. Chair, is to the path of this bill. It was my understanding as it left transportation that it was going to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. In fact, the chair made a remark to that effect at the time. There are new fines in this bill and a misdemeanor. I'm just curious why it's not going to Public Safety.
Mr. Chair, I did my understanding, and I didn't have a direct conversation with Chair Mariani, but my understanding was that the committee has either, I think, has some custom and usage around the level of the fine, and apparently this was not, it didn't meet that criteria. But it was, Representative Torkelson is correct that I think we did make a motion to Ways and Means with the possible recommendation to Public Safety. But that's my understanding indirectly from Public Safety staff.
Yeah, we had, that was the recommendation. I would be the one that would generally refer it to additional divisions. And we did get a an email from House Research, Public Safety typically does not hear misdemeanor penalties from chapters other than 609, 617, 624. I don't think they need to see this bill. So we relied on House Research in that regard. But it it only deals with misdemeanors, and they would not normally then be hearing those bills. So we did check on it. Any further discussion? Seeing none. Pardon? Oh, I didn't see your hand go up, Representative Torkelson.
Line of sight is somewhat blunt. Well, thank you.
Mr. This time Chair, I saw your hand go up. I didn't. She.
My understanding from what happened.
Keeps me on the straight and narrow.
Transportation Committee. But to the bill itself, Chair Hornstein, there are fines, additional fines in this bill. And tickets that could be issued, who would the tickets be issued to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Torkelson, my understanding of it would be the railroad that violates the section that's in 1.11 in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then who would pay the fine?
That would, my assumption would be that would be, again, the violating railroad company.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chair Hornstein and Mr. Chair. So we've seen evidence in committee that railroads are actually getting safer with the current crew setup. Is there some empirical evidence that would indicate that this is actually going to make railroads safer?
Representative Lawrence.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, I think that there are a number of sense that in some of these accidents that had there been additional crew, especially in terms of emergency response, there would have been a beneficial piece to that. We heard that kind of testimony also in the committee, and I think as we head towards perhaps increased automation, you know, I look at this as having two pilots in a aircraft as opposed to one. And I think, you know, given all kinds of issues that may happen to one operator, I think it's really, really helpful in terms of public safety to have two operators and a back, and one and a backup.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Met Council operates a number of trains. I believe they operate all of them with a single operator. Are you going to suggest that we broaden this requirement to put, for instance, two operators in a light rail train?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, we are looking at trains that, unit trains of 100 tanker cars of very highly volatile oil are rumbling through our neighborhoods and communities. This has been brought up many times on the House floor in the broader context of our oil transportation discussion. It's not just oil, Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson. There's anhydrous ammonia, other hazardous products, and that's certainly not analogous to a light rail train.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The testimony we've heard mostly deals with the result of a train car accident, not really having anything to do with what the train is carrying. And we've had certainly a lot of testimony on another bill about a light rail car accident where injuries, fatal injuries occurred. It seems like there's a close correlation.
Representative Hornstein,
well, I would just reiterate my earlier statement that I don't necessarily see an analogy to, you know, again, with the incident in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, was one of the motivators for me on this, and this was an accident where 47 people perished in a fireball. And we have to be very, very careful about ensuring safety when these very hazardous materials are transported through our communities. In very close proximity, as former Speaker Dowd has pointed out, close proximity to schools, hospitals, residences. This is a very important issue for our state.
Representative Torkelson, is that? Representative Hertos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hornstein. I, too, expressed some concern a little bit with regard to the actual products that are being moved. Freight trains move freight, and we've got light rail transports people, and yet the light rail, you know, government run is exempt from this proposed bill that you have. And, you know, I think that we see the private investment in the private sector rail service in terms of rebuilding the amount of dollars and miles that they spend in upgrading the lines and the systems. And I'm also aware of many of us probably don't think too much about seeing a train go by one direction and 10 minutes later you see the train go in the other direction. And you wonder how that can be. But it's very sophisticated logistics in terms of managing and caring for freight that's being shipped. And you know, one of the innovations that I'm seeing even in consumer vehicles is the fact that in my own car now, it displays the speed limit in the windshield. And I notice that when I come to a regulatory sign, it immediately knows that the speed has changed, and you'll see a change in the windshield. And that can only be due to the technologies of GPS knowing exactly where those regulatory signs are. And I make this point, Representative, that the same type of technologies exist with regard to operating freight rail. They know exactly where every crossing is. A lot of the sophisticated technologies in the trains warn of these things, but yet if there were two people in the recent light rail crash that took a young man's life, maybe that other person would have noticed there was a red light rather than driving straight through it. So that's the biggest concern I have with your legislation, is it really isn't addressing the most valuable cargo. That's the people that are on light rail trains.
Okay, we have Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, which other states have this additional government-mandated regulation?
Representative Hornstein.
I know Wisconsin is one of them. I'm not sure we have some others in the audience that might be able to just whisper in my ear and let me know. California, Arizona, and West Virginia, and our neighbors to the east.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I suspected California, and I expected, you know, New York and Connecticut and some other places too. But, well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, certainly I expect that the unions are advocating for this. And it's not a good thing that we are bringing a bill forward for government, obviously, to dictate to the railroads how they need to operate and spend their money to make their railroad safer. But I know I have been approached by the unions in past sessions, Representative Hornstein, so I know who's bringing the bill. It's the unions, because they want more membership and they want more dues and they want to make themselves stronger. This doesn't have anything to do with making the railroad safer. This is about a special interest bringing a bill forward and having government leverage its position right now here in Minnesota to dictate to the railroads that they are going to have more union employees, and that's just the way it is. And so they're going to have to spend that money there. They're not going to be able to spend it on innovative technologies to make railroads even safer or move goods even cheaper as they normally would operate. But instead, we're going to have this impediment in government in there that is going to limit them, limit commerce in our state, and slow Minnesota down relative to the rest of the country once again. So my frustrations with the bill, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Hornstein. And I thought there were more blue states in your list.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, there's a in your packets there are quite a number of handouts, but one that is helpful to know who is bringing this. The first page is the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. The second page is from the League of Minnesota Cities, who say in their letter, safety concerns about freight trains have become more pronounced for city leaders and residents as the number and length of trains have increased due to frac sand and crude oil entering the state by rail to and from North Dakota. During the 2015 interim, a committee of city officials spent considerable time learning about and discussing freight rail safety issues. They recommended the policy language we're discussing. The two letters following that come from the Minnesota Professional Firefighters and the Minnesota State Patrol, all of whom I suspect know something about safe response to accidents. I think it's important for the record to indicate who's bringing the bill.
Okay, and Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm you know, Representative Hornstein, you and I worked on train safety legislation jointly several years ago when I was chairing the property tax division, and we were looking at some strategies there. I'm hearing from the other side some opposition. I think back to our public safety workers, where we talk frequently about they want to go home to their families at night. And this is a public safety measure, and I want these train workers to go home to their families at night as well. And that fundamentally is the question in front of us, is do we work with the railroad industry and the railroad workers to make sure that the trains are operated in a safe manner that allows their passage through our communities and across our state to be done in as safe a way as possible, and to make sure that the workers are safe and get to go home at night. I appreciate your bringing this forward, because I would hope that people living long and healthy lives is a goal we can all embrace. Thank you, Chair Hornstein. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, you know, these fiscal notes that we get only tell about the cost to government. And I'm just wondering what the cost to the railroads and the private sector would be, if anyone has an idea of what this is going to cost the private sector. And I'm sure that they'll be passing along those increases to the consumer. And I just don't know if there's anybody in the audience that could answer that question, or if they have an idea. Mr. Chair, thank you.
I don't. Yeah, you can come forward if you'd like and identify. Did you hear the question?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Philip Qualley. I'm State Director for the Smart Transportation Division, formerly the United Transportation Union. And to answer your question, there is no increase in cost. I think there's a misconception with this bill that we're talking about actually increasing numbers of train crews. We're not. We're simply maintaining the train crews and the level of safety and the level of productivity and efficiency that the companies are enjoying now. Our primary responsibility is to protect public safety. That is our motivation, and we're asking for your support for this bill because we feel we are Minnesotans first. We are Minnesotans first, and we are trying to protect the public. Thank you.
Representative Scott. Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Representative Hornstein.
Good morning.
This is the first time that I've heard this bill, and so I just have a question. It seems to me that the crew size has always been an issue that has been relevant to the collective bargaining process. And so I'm just wondering, from the perspective that I come from, in terms of what has changed that has brought this bill forward. Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Albright, that's a great question, and I think I return to Representative Hausman's point that we have many more stakeholders in this issue beyond the unions and management. You have the League of Cities, you have citizens groups, you have public safety professionals. And I think what's changed is that, I think the nature of transporting hazardous materials has changed. And I think, again, the catalyst for me, and I think for many others who have been involved and concerned about rail safety, you know, does have to do with these high-profile accidents that did involve deaths and injuries, both, particularly in surrounding communities, and environmental issues. We've had ethanol trains that have leaked into the Mississippi River, and other incidents. There was a leakage on a train that was going from Red Wing to Winona several years ago, and had that not been in wintertime, I think we would have had a pretty major problem on the Mississippi River. So that's really what's changed, and I think this does go beyond collective bargaining to a real broader community safety issue.
Okay, we have Representative Bernardi.
I just wanted to briefly say we're using the words accidents a lot today, and these are derailments. One happened in my community not too long ago, and my community has very serious concerns about derailments, and this is an important bill for safety because it happened right in my own community, and it we were fortunate that it was a corn, but really not that fortunate than the fact that it created a huge mess and a huge impact on the homeowners in that area with little addressing the issues by the railroad. And so this doesn't necessarily affect the corn going in it, but derailments happen, and this is an important bill to pass for the safety of our public.
Okay, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, you mentioned Wisconsin earlier. It's my understanding that the Wisconsin law has been overturned by the courts. Is that correct? Perhaps your buddy.
Do you have an answer? Did you hear the question?
Yeah, I would, Mr. Chair, I call on Mr. Qualley to respond.
Mr. Chairman, again, Philip Qualley, ID. I'm happy to defer this to our counsel that is here, but short summary, following the Wauwega train wreck in Wisconsin in 1997 or so, where it was heroic work by the train crew to keep a town from blowing up, the town was evacuated for, I believe, 10 days. The state of Wisconsin passed a two-person crew law. The law in total was challenged by the railroads on federal preemption grounds. A portion of the state legislation in Wisconsin was ruled preempted. The standing portion of the law, of the Wisconsin law, which is still valid today, in which our bill in Minnesota, in California, West Virginia, Arizona, and 20 other states across the United States, is the remaining portion. So this legislation is not federally preempted, and it has not been tested in the federal courts by the railroads subsequent to the California passage most recently in 2014. Representative Torkelson, thank you. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is the West Virginia law is only goes into effect if surrounding states pass similar legislation. Is that correct?
I cannot speak to the West Virginia law other than it was brought up under the Conrail Termination Act, and the court wrote, if I may recite, first of all, that part of the Conrail Termination Act has been reserved by the courts. But the statutory purpose was originally enacted and has been clear, as I quote, excuse me, the Federal Railroad Safety Act and the Federal Railroad Administration comments of 2011 concluded that the statutory purpose for which Section 711-797J was originally enacted has been clearly satisfied. This is the West Virginia law. Conrail has been successfully returned to the private sector and no longer requires a special statutory exemption from state laws requiring it to employ a specific number of persons or persons in a particular task, function, or operation. Subsequently, in 2008, the FRA wrote, railroad carriers challenged the rule, prevailed, subsequently and affirmatively post-RSA 2008, that area of the law has been reserved. It is returned. It is appropriate. That purpose has been met and is appropriate to return primacy to state law. And I'm not an attorney, and so therefore after that I would refer to our counsel. But again, it says that primacy has been returned to state law.
Okay, let's see. We next have
one more question that relates to the cost of the railroads, and I believe that the railroads are prepared to remark on some of this testimony and what it may cost the railroads.
Yeah, Representative Torkelson, if you have a question of a person, that'll be fine. We'll entertain the question. So who is your question posed?
My question would be to the author, and do you, Representative Hornstein, do you understand the impact of this on the commercial railroads?
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes. And I believe that, again, as Mr. Qualley has pointed out, we are preserving the status quo, which is a two-person crew. And so I think that the railroads can certainly absorb any costs that accrue from this legislation.
Okay, Representative Torkelson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to hear that directly from the railroads if possible.
Yeah, we'll entertain the question then. Is there a spokesperson from the railroad that wants to entertain that question?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lydia Bjorge. I'm with BNSF Railway. There have been extensive studies on the costs of not being able to find efficiencies by taking away our ability to collectively bargain crew size, which is how it's been done for decades. I'll pass along that information and the studies found in that information to the committee after committee today. I also, if you're willing, would like to address the state other state law issues. Yep. Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson, is that part of your question?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
Specific to Wisconsin, like Mr. Qualley said, part of that law was overturned by the courts. At the time, the FRA had not acted on the other piece of law, so it was found that the in-the-yard moves were federally preempted because the FRA had acted in the circumstances of dictating how many crew and what the crew consists is for inside the yard but not over the road. Since the time of that case, which was a Doyle versus BNSF case, the FRA has taken substantial further action on the issue of crew size for over the road, and if re-litigated, we feel we would be successful in the preemption argument. There, of the four states that Mr. Qualley mentioned, there are no states that currently cite or in any way require the two people in the cab. So short lines use one person in the cab in Wisconsin, California, West Virginia, Arizona. So they're not enforced in any of those four states.
Representative Torkelson has said. I've got a question of you while you're at the table. What's the length of a train these days? And how many cars would it typically have?
Mr. Chair, typically 100, 110 cars is the standard.
And that would be in terms of length?
About a mile.
About a mile, okay. I think that's interesting as far as this discussion goes. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bjorke, if you would. Ms. Bjorke? Is it Bjorke?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Qualley mentioned four selected states, but then went on to mention there were 20. What are the other states and how blue are they?
I think that's a good point. So Wisconsin, we addressed. California passed, has never been enforced. West Virginia, there's statute in the books, but again, it doesn't go into effect unless all other surrounding states have the law. Arizona is not in effect. It was actually an anti-feather bedding statute that was passed that essentially took that statute out of play. In fact, the unions have introduced legislation in Arizona again, so that tells you something. The other 20 states, I think, was the number that Mr. Qualley mentioned. I imagine that's the number of states this bill has been introduced, but is there absolutely not law and is not, again, not enforced in any other state in the nation.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Scott,
then is the only state that it's actually being implemented in California?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, it is currently on the books in California. It is not enforced, meaning there are short lines in California who run one-person crews, and there has never been a citation or an enforcement of action in the state of California against those one-person crews, despite it being on the books.
Wow. So, Mr. Chair, it sounds like we're going to place ourselves into a situation that puts us at a competitive disadvantage to all those states. Thank you, Ms.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Hornstein, care to renew your motion?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I renew my motion that House File 286 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
We just had another name pop up. I was going by the list was complete, but Representative Garofalo.
My apologies, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to wrap things up, and that is that I want to disagree with my colleague, Representative Drazkowski. I have no concerns about this bill becoming law because it's not going to become law. So that's not an issue. What we're seeing, members, is that in a time when we're more successfully deploying technology, automation, and computerization, that we're seeing legacy institutions attempt to thwart that technology and those enhancements in productivity by preserving the existing labor structure they have. applying the same mindset to trucks is going to make a very difficult case for the automation that's coming in the trucking industry. And I would ask members to oppose this bill and say that we should allow this to be handled at the collective bargaining level between the unions and the railroads, and I would ask members for a no vote. Thank you.
Yeah, any further discussion? Seeing none, then, the motion is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. The next bill on
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
You're very welcome. And the next bill is 682, Representative Pulaski, the disaster contingency account. Representative Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move the division report.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Pulaski?
Then I'll move that House File 682 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us. If you'd care to explain the bill, Representative Pulaski?
House File 682 is a bill that has received a great deal of discussion this session. The Greater Minnesota Economic Development Committee has had two hearings just on this bill and the disaster account this session. There have been numerous bills introduced. What this bill does is backfill the account, which was underfunded for the last few years, add stability to the account, and then puts it in a position where if it has to be accessed, at least there would be funds in it. I believe we're down to about $100,000 in the account right now. The history of this goes back to the disaster of 2007, actually, with Rushford area and the creation of what was then Chapter 12A and subsequently Chapter 12B. Chapter 12B is where the account exists. We have two levels of disaster we can declare in this state: natural disasters. One is a presidential, the other is a gubernatorial. So with that, Mr. Chair, the bill simply adds stability to the account, and there will be other legislation coming during the budget so that when we are not in session, this account can be accessed. And I did have one document that I gave you. This was the last time that we had a special session for disaster relief in 2013, and you can see the agreement is here, signed by both Republicans and Democrats. And you can also see in the first paragraph that the word appropriation is spelled three different ways. And this is one of the reasons why a special session is not very special. We should at least have the time to be able to spell the word appropriation. So when I do that, this is from a presentation I've done numerous times in the public. If we can't spell appropriation, we shouldn't be allowed to do it. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll open for questions.
Any discussion either on the spelling of the word appropriation or the bill itself?
Representative Groff. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Pulaski. I would ask members to support this bill. Disaster relief is something that we come together with on a bipartisan basis. The reforms that Representative Pulaski has mentioned are a good idea so that we're not held up in global agreements going forward here, so that in future disasters do not require a special session. So I'd ask members to support this bill.
Okay, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, I want to thank you as well for bringing this forward. You've done good work over many years to establish this disaster contingency account. It was wise efforts. I think I see this, you know, to Representative Garofalo's use of the term global, I do see this as increasingly are anticipating natural disasters from global climate change. And I think the more we anticipate those disasters and prepare ourselves for the flooding, abrupt snowfalls, things like that, the wiser we are. So thank you, Representative Pulaski, for this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I want to make just a comment on what's been said. Both chapters 12A and 12B were prepared over the interim. Each of these chapters of law had as many as a dozen drafts that were rotated through the 13 different agencies and then the local units of government before the bill was introduced. So that once the bill was introduced, we had a fairly good idea of how this was going to work. This is not Pawlowski's disaster, Bill. I facilitated creating two chapters of law with the entities that were the experts on how this had to work. And the one thing we should all be proudest of, this has worked flawlessly in every disaster we have had since 2007. And we can't say that about many pieces of legislation. And there are people in the room today that should be given a lot of credit, the Department of Public Safety. I would also say DEED. But I'd also say all of the entities, the different agencies that continue to work on this. As we know, the disasters have changed. They have come at us from very different ways than we anticipated. We just passed a special bill last week on a unique type of a disaster dealing with agriculture. So these bills are going to have to continually be improved, and I appreciate the comment about being bipartisan. This issue should never be partisan. This should be when we are states' people. This is the best way this legislature has acted, and it must continue to act that way. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
And Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Pawlowski. I want to thank you for sharing the burden of both 12A and 12B with regard to disasters. And one of the communities that is my district right now is inundated by floodwaters to the extent that we've got backhoes trying to break up ice dams to save a trailer park from what I think is almost an imminent disaster. My point and my question to you, sir, is to the point of sufficiency. I know the bill suggests $10 million, and there are a number of other proposals that suggest a larger number, and I'm wondering if there's anything that you might suggest from an op-ed perspective in terms of what a sufficiency amount in this account might be in the interim when the legislature is not in session that would at least get the ball rolling forward so these communities don't have to wait for a special session.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, we're looking at least $20 million, $10 million in each year of the biennium for funding, and we may actually see more than that considering what's happened with weather over the recent winter. So I'm hopeful that in the budget that we will have before the House and the governor's recommendation, we'll have a minimum of about $20 million that will be in the account. And remember, this is only accessed when there is a disaster. If the governor calls it or the president, it still has to be okayed by House and Senate leadership. And then protocols are put in place. And this does not pay for the entire disaster. This pays for things that have to be paid up front, and then we will get the bill. But the bill will be an accurate bill, not like it was when we had the disaster in southeastern Minnesota when we were throwing money at everything. These bills have worked. And, of course, the one that comes to mind is in 2015 when Representative Knobloch carried the first of the bills. I think it was House File 164. And that paid for the disaster of 2013. So this is exactly what we need to do, and we should do it.
Thank you, Manager. Representative Dabney, I thought you were on our list. Okay, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Rep. Pawlowski, for carrying this bill. I, too, share the concern about the adequacy of the funding. But with that said, I think you partly answered my other concern or question. If we were to park money or to reserve money and have it available so it could be used and acted upon quickly, is there any type of safeguards or oversight that that a governor may not overspend a situation or make sure that the money is used in its most efficient manner or wisely and not just at the sole discretion of one person just decide how much money an area is going to get?
Mr. Chair, reps have heard us. There is no funding in this process that is at the whim of any individual. Once a declaration is made, you have both federal and state law that now go into a series of protocols. And they will address the limits to what the spending will be or the amounts that will be spent in certain categories. But again, and then we review it when it comes to us. So there's never been a difficulty here with spending. The difficulty was when we had a special session, and then when the legislative auditor did a review in 2012 of what happened during that special session, then we had problems. And that's when 12A was created, and then 12B, to make sure that we could not have that happen again. And the result was unfortunate for certain areas of southeastern Minnesota. There were, shall we say, elected officials that did not return to office.
Representative Herthoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Rep. Pawlowski, for that. I remember that we passed the bill in 13. I just didn't remember some of the details of it, so thank you for filling me in on that. And I'm happy to appropriate or however we spell it, money to this bill.
Hey, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would note that there is a challenge with small communities in large counties that may have a disaster, and because of the per capita inability to have a disaster declaration because of the size of the county. And I'll use specifically, Representative Albright, I think you remember this, the city of Mendota, which if Mendota was located in a rural county, it would have been eligible, but it was in Dakota County. So a town of 110 people had to come up with $60,000 for a road going down the bluff. And they never got reimbursed for that. And we spent a very long time trying to work to see if the fund would cover it. So nothing's perfect.
Okay, any further discussion? Well, seeing none, then the Pawlowski motion that House File 682 be recommended to be placed on the General Register is before us. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative
Thank
Pawlowski,
you, Mr. Chairman.
We now go to House File 85, Representative Brand.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Health and Human Services Finance Division Report on House File 85.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now I will move House File 85, the first engrossment, to be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Would you care to explain the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, House File 85 is a bill that's similar to what we've seen before in the House. Anyone in this committee could have carried this bill. It represents people across the state that have rare diseases in which it would be best if EMS professionals were to give or administer life-saving drugs at the time of arrival versus hauling them back to the hospital where a doctor would administer those life-saving drugs. And so we all, in each of our districts, we have folks that have rare diseases. And so it's important, I believe, that we carry this bill forward. It was in the budget bill last year, but it was vetoed. And so, bipartisan support on this bill this year. What it does is authorizes EMTs, AMTs, and paramedics to administer those drugs and would require the EMS board to develop protocols and then report back to the legislature next year. We would adopt those protocols, I hope, and then we would carry this forward.
Okay, any discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the author, are you aware of any opposition to your bill at all?
Representative Brandt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, initially there was some opposition, and we addressed that by amending the bill. There was some language in there about creating a plan or allowing paramedics to help people with rare diseases to create a plan for action in case something were to happen. The Minnesota Nurses Association had some heartburn about that, so we removed it.
And Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that this is a feast in the valley bill is the way it was explained to me, so given that fact, I would ask for members to support it.
Appreciate any further discussion. Seeing none, then the motion before us is that House File 85, the first engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we now have House File 408,
or excuse me, 1408, by Representative Deagle. Welcome to the committee. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe there is an amendment as well.
Yeah, we have, Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Transportation Finance and Policy Division report on House File 1408.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Hornstein. I guess I'm okay. The one that needs to move the bill.
That wasn't on my feet.
So, or I'm the one that could. I will move the House File 1408 as amended, be recommended to be placed in the general register. And if you could explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The House File 1408 is the flaggers bill. So what this would do is it would allow flaggers in work zones to cite folks who disobey orders just like they do with the school bus arm law.
Okay, and then there's an amendment that Representative Keagle has requested.
So that would just delete sections one.
I will move the amendment for House File 1408, and it's number 11, A11. It's in our packets. If you could explain the amendment.
Yep. So thank you, Mr. Chair. What the amendment would do is delete sections one, which was the bitter language that we could not come to agreement on with MnDOT, and then sections three and four, which is prohibition on cell phone use in work zones. So really what we want to do is just keep the meat of the bill, allowing the flaggers to call police enforcement when somebody is in violation of obeying their orders in a work zone.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Any further discussion? Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question. You've been thinking about this bill, and what is your take on whether or not the flagger will be distracted from their regular duties if they have to deal with trying to make contact with police officers regarding the misbehavior of a driver in their vicinity?
Representative Keagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Torkelson. A lot when we in committee, what we heard is that a lot of these flaggers work in teams, and so at one end of the work zone, they can let the other flagger know that somebody disobeyed their orders, and they can work together to collect the information they need to, and then they also have they have 4 hours to do that. So I believe they would be able to take a break to call in any kind of law enforcement they need.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. 1408 down. Okay, the motion before us is that House File 1408, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried.
No.
I just want to commend the author of the bill. I'm just wondering if that child would be available for me to borrow when I present the bill to minimize difficult questioning.
Are you saying that helped put the bill over?
Mr. Chair, that's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah, that's
exactly.
Well, I suspect we're going to see the author of the bill on the House floor using the exact same tactic. So,
I one time we had a very brief floor session, and I had my grandson, who's now a junior in college, with me. That wasn't, I think, maybe a little bit older, who fell sound asleep on my shoulder on the House floor. And they took a picture, and it went statewide. So when I realized it went statewide was when Marty Seifert, if you'll remember Marty Seifert, brought in the picture. It had been in the Worthington newspaper.
And, Mr. Chairman, this was your nephew, you said?
No, my grandson.
And that grandson's name was Leon Lilly.
No, I'm just kidding.
Mr. Chairman.
No, but that grandson.
I had a good nap.
if we're done with our business, may I ask two quick questions?
That's fine.
It's kind of tradition in this committee, the minority lead has to ask, number one, when do you expect to see the targets out? And number two, what is the actual deadline day for when the targets for our House rules need to be
released? It's the 25th, and the rule is that after the forecast, we have 25 days to put the budget resolution together. So my plan right now is that we will be taking it up on the 25th.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion before we adjourn then? Thank you. Meeting adjourned.